This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We all know the game from childhood. Rock beat scissor, scissor beat paper, paper beat rock beat scissors. What you don't understand is that the 1% of this planet uses the paper game to control all things generation, generation, generation. I invite you global people to come together like rock, five finger form fist, and destroy this absolute tyranny. Don't drill into Mother Earth, don't create this chaos. Rock go strike Goliath dead. Pull back the sling.
Forget about giant technology to suck out the carbon from the atmosphere. If you worry about the climate, you have to save tropical rainforests. Coming up, we'll talk with the doyen of forest activism, Frances Seymour from the World Resources Institute. But first, one of the top American climate scientists, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck, on science that warns the whole world will be reclothed in unpredictable ways as the climate goes out of control. How do we know? It has happened before when the world warmed 5 degrees centigrade. I'm Alex, and this is Radio Climate Shock. With our current level of carbon emissions, scientists worry we could go over 4 degrees C of warming in less than 100 years. The last time Earth warmed that much, the plants clothing the planet changed, along with the species. We know that because of new research just published in the journal Science on August 31, 2018. My journey through that paper was filled with exclamation marks and oh my God notes. Our guest, Dr. Jonathan T. Overpeck, was a major author in that work. Overpeck has been a lead author for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has often briefed Congress on climate in the days when Congress cared about such things. He advises governments, edits scientific journals, and organizes conferences. He's published over 200 papers on climate and the environment. After a long career at the University of Arizona, Jonathan Overpeck is now with the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. Dr. Overpeck, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good afternoon.
The new paper in Science predicts unimaginable things. It sounds like we're heading towards a different place where humans today would hardly recognize their surroundings. Is that possible?
Well, you know, when you look at the world, there are a lot of things that are kind of permanent, and those include mountains and coastlines, for example. But when you think about it, a lot of what we have on our planet is framed in terms of natural or managed vegetation. The plants we see, the ecosystems that they support. And that's what we focused on in this paper, and the fact that they are going to change a lot more in all likelihood than we thought before.
Just before we dive deep into the science, I note this one chilling phrase in the introduction. It says, ecosystem change is accelerated by mass mortality of incumbent dominance. Now, you're talking about plant life there, but we need plants for food. Am I crazy to wonder if under the worst climate scenario, humans may also be incumbent dominants that experience mass mortality?
Well, that wasn't the focus of the paper, but there are other works that have been carried out that suggest that mortality will go up among humans, particularly those that are less able to adapt in really rapidly changing situations. And just imagine, right now we're about 7 billion people on this planet, and the current projections are by 2050 to be at around 11 billion. So at the same time, we're going to have to be feeding and providing water and other life-sustaining resources for this large increase in people. We're going to be battling climate change and the impacts of that climate change that are probably going to, in many cases, reduce our ability to feed and to provide water and other essentials for humans to thrive.
Okay, so there are 42 authors listed in this paper, chosen from experts all over the world. Why so many authors?
Well, we had really two phases of this project. And in order to carry out the research, we needed to have expertise from around the world. The first stage was to look at the vegetation change that took place during the last deglaciation that started around 21,000 years ago. So we, in order to carry out this project, we needed expertise around the world. We're interested in studying the vegetation change that occurred during the last deglaciation and understanding the relationship between that dramatic vegetation change everywhere on the planet and warming that occurred and, in fact, drove most of that vegetation transformation. We're then going to use the relationship between the past temperature warming and the vegetation change to understand the way in which temperature can change vegetation. And then we're going to apply that to the future. And in order to do this and be sure we were doing it well, we needed expertise from around the planet so that we had expertise not just in North America, where I'm from, but we had expertise from every nook and cranny of the planet.
Right. It's an impressive list. People from China, people from just pretty well every biological system were there. And I wanted to ask you, how confident were your experts that the big changes observed in plant life then when the world warmed thousands of years ago was due to climate change?
Well, that's something we explicitly asked them to assess. We first wanted them to tell us what vegetation change occurred, both in terms of vegetation structure and composition. And then we wanted them to give us confidence estimates for that change. And then we asked them to estimate the degree to which temperature likely drove those changes. We didn't want to get in a situation where we were mixing changes that were, say, due to humans at the end of the deglaciation into the present day, or changes that were related to, say, CO2 increasing over the deglaciation, or maybe even precipitation change.
Right. Composition and structure are mentioned all throughout the paper and in the graphs. And unfortunately, I had to go to the supplementary materials to find out what those key terms meant. What do they mean, and why break things down into those two categories?
Well, we wanted to get measures of vegetation change that people could relate to. And those terms are technical terms, but they're pretty easy to understand. The structure of the vegetation is the sort of the dominant form that the vegetation takes. For example, is it tree-covered? Is it deciduous trees or evergreen trees? Or is it a savanna, grassland, or desert? So these are big changes in the overall structure of the vegetation. The composition is a little more subtle. It's the change in the dominant species of plants that are growing in the vegetation. And a lot of people could understand this. If you're in North America, say, are you going to shift from a pine-dominated forest to a spruce-dominated forest? Doesn't take often as much climate change to change the composition, but to change the structure, it's usually a bigger change.
So as I understand it, long ago there was a warming of about 5 degrees centigrade, about what the worst scenario is now for the year 2100 or 2150. But it took about 7,000 years for that warming to complete its process. How worthwhile are your study results when we're comparing 7,000 years to 150 years of warming?
Well, what we're interested in is getting an empirical estimate of how big the vegetation change could be, meaning something grounded in real observations as opposed to a model, which is all we've been able to do to this point, the scientific community. We wanted something grounded in real, this is what happened data. And so we had to take this imperfect comparison and use it. And it makes our results conservative. So what I mean is, what we are looking at is what kind of vegetation change is likely for a given amount of temperature change. We wanted to see that in over the entire planet projecting into the future. And we can actually develop a functional relationship between temperature and vegetation change for this longer period in the past. But we do acknowledge that it's going to just all happen so much faster in the future. And that makes our results conservative in the sense of what's going to happen in the future is going to be a lot more chaotic and difficult to predict because it's going to go so fast. It's also going to be more chaotic because there's going to be changes associated with human land use, pollution, you know, and all sorts of other human activities that are going to work with climate change to really transform our planetary landscapes.
Now, as you know, some scientists suggest changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide alone can affect plant life, even without climate change. How did your study decide the big changes in plants were due to climate and not just more CO2?
Well, you know, the changes that occurred in the past undoubtedly have a small element of CO2 forcing. But what we did is we went to lengths to sort of review that literature about how CO2, and in particular CO2 increases that occurred over the deglaciation, affect vegetation. They weren't that large, about 30%. Not that large compared to what we're doing now. And we concluded, based on the evidence, that CO2 effects on the vegetation change were secondary to temperature. Temperature was the dominant driver of this widespread or global reorganization of vegetation that took place on the deglaciation.
And according to your tabulation of global studies, some parts of the world will see greater changes than others. Can you tell us where some of the places where big changes will take place?
Well, the changes are ubiquitous, and I think this is, to me, the most important finding. In previous studies, we found, not us, but the scientific community, using models of climate and vegetation, we found regions of large changes separated by regions of small changes. And what our new paper shows is that the change is likely to be everywhere. And that's what happened on the deglaciation. Almost everywhere changed. And as you say, some places will be less at risk of change than others. It turns out that the Andes in South America are a place that have proven because to be more resilient to these large temperature changes. But the higher latitudes, they're going to see the biggest change.
And that's where most of my listeners live, I would add. You've talked about the difference in the future plant world. Is it wildly different if we manage to stay under 2 degrees compared to going over 4 degrees C of warming?
Yes. If we cause a large-scale climate change, essentially by leaving our emissions of greenhouse gases at the current rate for this century, we'll see changes comparable around the planet to the last deglaciation in many cases. What we were able to do in this study is actually calculate the risk of major structural or compositional changes. And with business as usual emissions, the risks of major transformation are in the 60 to 70% range. Whereas if we're able to curtail the emissions of greenhouse gases to, say, the levels agreed to in the Paris recently, then many parts of the world would have a risk of transformation, compositional change, less than 50%. So it really shows in stark terms how an effort to curtail our greenhouse gas emissions could really benefit pretty much everywhere on the planet in terms of vegetation change.
How much does it matter that your study period began with extreme cold in glacial times, whereas we're starting with the warmth of the Holocene and heading towards a hothouse Earth?
Yes. One of the things that, like with the rate of change, that's a real wild card going into the future, real complicating factor, is that we'll be going not from glacial to interglacial, but we're going from interglacial to super interglacial, a really hot world. Particularly if we don't curtail our greenhouse gas emissions, that many of the plants on the planet haven't seen in millions of years in their evolutionary history. And many of the climates we'll see in the future will be, therefore, so different from anything on the planet today that it'll be, again, very hard to estimate exactly what the changes will be. We just know they'll be large, and we don't know the exact pattern. So that'll mean a lot of difficulty in managing this change. And unfortunately, that just will make the impacts worse.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, American climate scientist, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck. We are talking about a big new paper titled Past and Future Global Transformation of Terrestrial Ecosystems Under Climate Change. And I noticed that in 2008, for example, we broadcast a speech of yours at the University of Washington. You talked about the drying of the West, and now here we are seeing many and more wildfires in the West. Our Canadian fire expert, Mike Flanagan, told us under certain conditions, the forest may not even return. And our government said that some of the forests in the south of BC will become grasslands instead. You've written extensively on the west of North America. What do you think is happening when it comes to wildfires and drought?
Well, what's happening in North America, western North America? I'm actually in a scientific workshop on that topic now, preparing a presentation for tomorrow. And there's a lot of debate as the Southwest Millennium Drought, a name that's not formally been widespread, but I think that's what you'd call it. It's been going on now for almost 19 years. And it all started back in 1999 when the big reservoirs on the Colorado were full, Lake Mead and Lake Powell, and the levels in those reservoirs have plummeted as drought has more often than not plagued the region. And you're seeing signs of the same change across the entire west of North America and down into Mexico. And what's really happening is, of course, we have precipitation deficits, and you know, drought is often thought of as a precipitation deficit, but what we're seeing more and more is a role of temperature warming in drying out the Southwest and the West generally. And this means the snow is melting earlier, and vegetation, forests, and soils have a chance to start drying out earlier. And this moves up the timing of the fire season, and it makes it much longer. And during that fire season, we're talking about wildfire and forests, the warmer temperatures are drying out the vegetation more. And in some cases, the effect of the warming and the drying has been so dramatic that it has literally killed trees outright. A good example of that is in the Four Corners region of the West, you know, primarily in New Mexico. And it's pretty clear now that temperature is just going to have a bigger and bigger effect on our vegetation. So we're getting this big uptick in tree mortality. We've seen it now, tree death. We've seen this in the Four Corners region. We've seen this in California now after their drought. We're seeing a big uptick in huge, severe wildfire. We're seeing more insect outbreaks as the trees are less able to fight off the insects and pests and pathogens because they're stressed by lack of water and warmth, but also because some of these pests and pathogens have more life cycles and other things that are favored by warmer temperatures. All of this together makes the western United States, and particularly the Southwest, kind of like the canary in the mine shaft for this large-scale vegetation change we're going to see in the future around the entire planet. And you're not only seeing it in the Southwest U.S., but you're seeing it other parts of the world as well, for example, Western Australia.
And I'd like to read you one more sentence that really stuck out to me out of many in the paper. It says, quote, "Although many ecological responses like species migration, colonization, and succession will likely lag behind climate change, the transformations will often be accelerated by disturbance and land use and invasive species." Now, to me, that sounds like some of the climate conditions needed to support some species will have already changed before they move on and die. In other words, we may not really know what's happened until we see things start to disappear around us.
Yeah, I think one of the real concerns that we've stressed in this paper is the inherent unpredictability of the details of the change. But in order to get vegetation change, for example, you need to disturb the vegetation. You can get very slow change as new plants start to that are more favored by the warmed climate start to establish and grow within a forest, say. But you can change things much faster if you have a large wildfire, clears out the old vegetation and lets the new vegetation come in. And we're seeing that in this process already play out in the West. But we don't know exactly what's going to seed in there and how well it will fare before it becomes too warm for those new plants that are establishing. And, you know, the idea of these invasive species, these species that are brought in from afar, say from Africa. A good example would be down in the Sonoran Desert. We have these grasses that came from the Mediterranean and Africa regions, and these get into the desert. The grasses are very flammable, but yet the traditional desert vegetation that's been there for millennia is not adapted to fire. So you all of a sudden are going to really change the dynamics of the vegetation and how that vegetation will respond to climate. But it's going to be unpredictable.
And I think we could probably do several more studies just based on this one about what could happen for mass agriculture that's currently feeding the billions of current humans.
Yeah, you know, there's. I don't work on the agricultural side of climate change impacts, but it strikes me that one of the things that needs to be emphasized is that our natural vegetation provides a lot of services for humans. It's not just something pretty to look at, but it provides food, it provides fiber, think of it, building materials. It often is essential for water supplies to remain secure. And, of course, biodiversity and all the animals that live in the vegetation around the planet, some of which are sources of food, others are sources of pharmaceutical raw ingredients. These are all things that are provided by the natural vegetation of the planet that could be lost before we even know it.
And I worry that people are so disconnected from the plant world. I mean, kids may think food comes from supermarkets or maybe it's made in factories, and meanwhile, we're checking updates on social media and looking for shocking news. But what could be more shocking, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck, than to say that the whole plant world of this earth could change very rapidly due to our emissions?
It really should be a major headline. And you're just in the oceans, it's the same thing is happening as we, warming temperatures and acidification are destroying coral reefs around the planet and really affecting fisheries. Sight unseen to most people who live on land. At least the vegetation change, when it starts to really pick up, is pretty clear. And I would say in the Western United States, most of us this summer even realize, you know, things are really changing. All the smoke that we had across the entire West really is a clear reminder of the kind of change we're talking about. People think of it as wildfire, out of control wildfire. But what it really is a mechanism for vegetation change. And I think hopefully people will start to realize, hey, this is a big deal.
Jonathan, what will you be working on next?
I'm really interested in what this means in terms of management possibilities. What I'm worried about is in our paper, we highlighted that even if we do get emissions under control, emissions of greenhouse gases, that is, we're still going to get some serious change. But I am an optimist, and as a scientist, I think we can manage that change and maintain the ecosystem services that are so critical for human life support. And that's what I really want to focus time on, is how can we do a much better job of managing the transformation that's already taking place in the West, and learning from that, hopefully be able to help manage the transformation in vegetation that is going to inevitably occur across the United States and around the planet. If we can manage it, I think we have a real chance of coming out of this okay. But implicit in this is that we just cannot allow greenhouse gas emissions to go unchecked. Because if we drive the vegetation too hard, too fast with big time warming, it could be just unmanageable.
And just on a personal note, you worked at the NASA Goddard Institute of Space Studies in the late 1980s. Did you meet James Hansen there?
In fact, Jim Hansen was the guy who recruited me to come to NASA GIS. And it's kind of funny because in this context, is what he wanted me to do back in the late 80s was to help his team, which is trying to model all the changes that were coming down the pike, to try and build in dynamic vegetation into their climate model. And I was just fresh PhD, figured I could figure anything out. And, you know, I learned pretty quick that the job I was tasked with doing was an exceedingly difficult job. And in fact, even to this day, I think our new paper in Science shows that our models of global vegetation are still too primitive to give us the kind of information we need to manage or anticipate and manage future change. But without any doubt, you know, my chance to meet Jim Hansen really changed my life because I realized at that point, you know, it was that era when he was testifying before Congress in the summer of 88, you know, saying climate change is happening. And it really sunk in for me, you know, that this was going to be my career, trying to understand this incredible thing we're doing to the planet, hopefully get out the word about what we're doing, and hopefully understand it well enough to manage it and to prevent the worst things from happening. And that set the stage for my career probably as much as anything.
That's a beautiful circle that he got you going on that, and here you are with one of the important papers along with your team of 42 scientists. We have been speaking with one of the great American climate scientists, in my opinion, Dr. Jonathan Overpeck, and his long title, he's the Samuel A. Graham Dean and William B. Stapp Collegiate Professor of Environmental Education at the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. The paper we've been discussing is titled Past and Future Global Transformation of Terrestrial Ecosystems Under Climate Change, as published in the journal Science, August 31st, 2018. You can find all the links you need in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Jonathan Overpeck, thank you so much for sharing this valuable time with us.
It was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you. I think it's great that you're able to go into this level of detail. It's not often that that occurs, and I think it's an important thing, what you're doing.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Despite what you've heard, planet Earth is losing its forest cover. All that stored carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere, adding to climate change, not to mention what it does to the species who live there. What is driving deforestation? Vast wildfires? Logging? Farming? Yes and no. A recent study reveals all. Our guest Frances Seymour speaks at world conferences on these very issues. She was Director General of the Center for International Forestry Research, CIFOR, and is now a Distinguished Senior Fellow at the World Resources Institute. Frances is the lead author of the book Why Forests, Why Now? The Science, Economics, and Politics of Tropical Forests and Climate Change. Frances Seymour, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Have you been to Indonesia recently, and if so, what were you doing there?
Well, the last time I was in Indonesia was back in the spring, and the work I do there is to support colleagues who are particularly focused on trying to reduce deforestation and peatland conversion based on the expansion of the oil palm industry.
And I guess that's still growing and still going, is it, the palm oil industry in Indonesia?
It is. It's emerged in recent years as the number one driver of forest loss and peatland conversion. And while the tree cover loss numbers for 2017 showed a significant downturn from previous years, which was very much good news, I don't think the battle is yet won.
And I remember in 1997-98, the peat fires in Indonesia pushed that nation, I think it was to number three amongst the world's largest sources of carbon dioxide. It was just behind the United States and China. So is it still burning there each year, sending clouds of smoke as far as Malaysia?
You know, it varies from year to year. 2015 was the most catastrophic year, and in that period, on certain days in the late fall, there were more emissions from the fires coming from Indonesia than from the entire U.S. economy. So these remain globally significant events from the point of view of the atmosphere. But I think maybe what's less known to people in the United States is that it's also a significant public health crisis. There's a study that estimated that those fires caused on the order of 100,000 premature deaths from, you know, respiratory disease caused by the heavy load of particulates that are released by these fires. So while the haze may close the airport in Singapore from time to time, the real damage is to the lungs of the people who live in the area.
Oh, my God. I hadn't heard that figure, and that is just huge. You spoke at the World Tropical Forest Conference in Oslo last June, and what was the mood there? What was the purpose of the conference?
The purpose of the conference was to bring together a diverse group of stakeholders who are concerned about the issue of tropical deforestation and mobilizing to bring together the variety of tools that we have to address it. The occasion was essentially the 10-year anniversary since the international community discovered the importance of tropical forests to the global climate system and the initiation of negotiations to bring forests into the global climate agreement that eventually emerged in Paris in 2015. And since then, there has been a large community of actors that have come together to really try to work together and do something about it. So the mood at the meeting was interesting in that it had two parts. On the one hand, the meeting was the occasion for the release by my colleagues at Global Forest Watch of the 2017 numbers for global tree cover loss. And unfortunately, those numbers showed that 2017 was another record-breaking year for global tree cover loss, just down slightly from the record-breaking numbers in 2016. So we still have not turned the tide on the battle, and there's a lot to do. On the other hand, there was an appropriate sense of accomplishment in that there has been a huge amount of progress along a number of milestones toward what we know needs to happen to slow down and eventually halt deforestation. So, for example, there were discussions about the latest advances in the technology for monitoring forest cover change, which has been just phenomenal. You know, 10 years ago, we were relying on government statistics that were self-reported by governments and often out of date or using inappropriate methods. And now we have globally available data that's consistent across geographies and over time that has sufficient temporal and spatial resolution to empower, say, law enforcement officials to go out and actually catch illegal loggers in the act. And so that kind of technology breakthrough is empowering a lot of action to improve forest management that hasn't been available before. I would also stress that, you know, norms have evolved over the last 10 years where, you know, that kind of illegal activity was something that was hush-hush or not talked about a lot 10, 15 years ago, and now it is definitely common parlance among governments who in the past would not have wanted to talk about these issues but now are stepping forward to exercise leadership. And actually, Indonesia is one of those countries which has been the first just 2 years ago to sign an agreement with the European Union to be able to export timber to the European Union that is certified as legally produced. Another norm shift has been with response to the role of indigenous peoples in forest management. In the past, indigenous peoples were often ignored, their rights were not recognized, they're often and continue to be today on the front lines of defending forests and quite often are murdered for their efforts in that regard. And yet now it's really, you know, no one really questions the right of indigenous peoples to their ancestral territories and their right to be at the table in national and international policy arenas where the fate of the world's forests is being discussed. And that's important because when you actually look at the maps and overlay where there are indigenous peoples and where there is remaining forests, there's a very high degree of overlap. And it's fair to say that, you know, a large proportion of the world's remaining terrestrial carbon stored in forests is under the control of indigenous peoples, and so they are really the frontline defenders. The other thing that we were talking about in Oslo is the role of commodity-driven deforestation. A recent paper that came out actually just this week in Science magazine gave detail on, you know, what's been the primary driver of tree cover loss and permanent deforestation around the world. And it's clear that in Brazil, particularly the Amazon region, and in Indonesia and more broadly in Southeast Asia, the overwhelming driver of deforestation has been this expansion of production of commodities, so not only palm oil, but also beef, soy, other globally traded commodities. And the advocacy efforts that forest loss has generated by groups such as Greenpeace has in turn precipitated a whole wave of commitments by private companies up and down the supply chains saying that, you know, they don't want to be in the business of contributing to deforestation, so they've committed to stop sourcing from recently deforested lands for those commodities. That remains very much a work in progress, and there's a long way to go, but it certainly helps to have major corporations saying they want to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. last but not least, and in fact really the focus of the book that you mentioned in my introduction, is the critical role of finance in getting this done. Right now, the preponderance of financial flows at the global level are driving deforestation. You know, it's easier to get access to agricultural credit or investment for activities that actually cause forest loss, as opposed to getting access to finance that rewards protecting the forest. And we really need to right that balance as soon as possible. So a lot of the discussions in Oslo were about how to, you know, stack various kinds of finance, whether it's carbon finance or blended finance with private sector investment in various forms of sustainable investments in the agriculture and forest sectors to try to change the incentives that govern rural land use.
I've just found a terrific new paper titled Classifying Drivers of Global Forest Loss. It was led by Philip G. Curtis from the University of Arkansas and released on September 13th. And Curtis got that information by comparing Google Earth satellite photos over 14 years since 2001. Have you seen that paper?
I have, and in fact, my colleague Nancy Harris at World Resources Institute was one of the co-authors of that paper.
Well, it appears from that study that logging and wildfires are almost tied for the amount of forest devastation around the world. It's behind commodities, but still very important, and those two together account for about half our total tree loss each year. And from our experience in the West here, where everything seemed to be burning down, I'm going to bet that wildfires may overtake logging as climate change ramps up. What do you think?
Well, yes and no. I think what's important is that it's a false distinction to try to say, is it wildfires or is it logging or any other human incursion into the forest? Because what the science is pretty clear on is that forests become more vulnerable to wildfire because of prior human incursion. It's actually very difficult to set an intact tropical rainforest on fire. You know, it's just by definition, it's a moist environment. And so it's when those forests become fragmented, you know, and openings in the canopy that dry out the soil surface, or the logging waste that's left behind that dries out and becomes flammable timber, or in the case of Indonesia where a peatland has been disturbed and the hydrology disturbed and therefore drained and it dries out, that's when it becomes flammable. So to try to divide into neat categories what is wildfire and what is logging or any other forest use is kind of a false distinction. Having said that, it's clear that the climate is changing and leading to more severe extreme weather events, you know, more extended droughts, extended fire seasons, higher temperatures, which make forests more vulnerable to fire. So we do have some shifts, and certainly, you know, where you are in British Columbia or here where I am today in California, you know, we're seeing an unusual level of fire alerts, you know, say the highest, you know, over the last few year period. So things are changing. And I think it's kind of scary because this could be a positive feedback loop in the sense that you have climate change causing the higher temperatures, the longer dry seasons, which in turn cause more wildfires, which in turn cause more global warming emissions, which in turn cause more global warming, and you can see how this cycle goes. And it also interacts in the tropics, especially with the hydrological functions of forests in terms of evapotranspiration and generating the clouds that generate the rain. And there was a kind of frightening paper published in Science Advances a few months ago by Thomas Lovejoy and Carlos Nobre talking specifically about the Amazon forest and warning that, you know, we could be approaching a tipping point where certain forests are lost at above a level of around 25%. You could kick this into a cycle that eventually tips the whole climate system in the region over to where, you know, we're not going to get those forests back. And in the meantime, we've destroyed the hydrological patterns that provide the rainfall to important agricultural areas. So, you know, it is urgent that we stop this.
Well, Frances Seymour, in your blog at WRI, you report tree cover loss in Brazil doubled from 2015 to 2017. We all thought that was under control. There was good news coming from the Amazon. Maybe even deforestation was going down. What happened?
Well, a couple couple things. One is that even though these numbers in Brazil have ticked up the last couple of years, it's important to keep them in perspective because when compared to the level of forest loss in the mid, you know, the first decade of this century, you know, 2003, 2004, they're still historically much lower than that. So I think it's important to give Brazil credit for the 75-80% decrease in the deforestation rate from those highs 15 years ago. And so while, yes, they are ticking up, they are still lower than they were. And so it's important to give Brazil credit for keeping an enormous quantity of carbon dioxide emissions out of the atmosphere that would otherwise have gone in if that deforestation, you know, had not been brought under control. I think that the uptick in deforestation rates in Brazil are collateral damage from the broader economic and political crisis that has been consuming Brazil over the last couple of years. And so, for example, you know, there has been a decrease in budgets for some of the important law enforcement efforts that were part of the success story a decade ago. And so I think it's part of a broader point that often while a catastrophic event like forest fires in Indonesia can put deforestation at the top of the political agenda temporarily, it's often hostage to the economic and political cycles that affect all countries, including our own, and may not get the kind of sustained attention that it needs to really overcome the problem.
Well, we've heard that war can affect deforestation, but then I was surprised to find that in Colombia it was peace that led to greater forest loss. Can you talk to us briefly about that?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting research about the relationship between conflict and deforestation. And sometimes, you know, conflict can make areas so dangerous that people can't go into them for economic activity, and so it has the effect of protecting the forest, although no one would advocate for, you know, exacerbating conflict and as a conservation strategy. In Colombia, which I don't know well, but I understand from colleagues, is that an unfortunate artifact of the peace agreement is that places have become, in fact, safe enough for land grabbers to rush in and start clearing the forest in sort of a speculative way, and it's just been difficult to get on top of that quickly. So it's an example of a place where international support to provide incentives, be they the kinds of performance-based finance incentives allowed under the Paris Agreement on Climate Change to reward, you know, financially jurisdictions that protect forests, or whether it's incentives from private sector companies to source sustainably produced commodities from those regions as opposed to those that come from deforestation, are all very much needed at this point, particularly in Colombia.
This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We are talking about the disappearing forest cover on this planet and what we can do about it with distinguished senior fellow at the World Resources Institute, Francis Seymour. The Deutsche Welle news agency reports, quote, "The world is losing vital forests quicker than ever. The years 2016 and 2017 saw the highest global tree cover loss ever recorded." So, Francis, are we losing the battle to keep forests worldwide?
Well, one always has to maintain hope that we are at a tipping point. And so I have been gratified this week here in San Francisco, for example, to hear a lot of positive stories about, for example, indigenous communities that have been successful in using drone-based monitoring to detect and repel encroachments on their indigenous territories. And, you know, these are technologies that were not available even a few years ago. So we're just beginning to see the fruits of those kinds of initiatives. I was gratified to hear a number of public statements from political leaders, governors, for example, of many of the tropical forest-rich jurisdictions, saying not only making, you know, proclamations that, oh, we are going to, you know, do things to stop deforestation, but reporting on what they had already done in terms of, for example, canceling mining licenses or other forest concessions in order to protect forests. And so I really feel like we are at a point where we have the tools at our disposal and we could turn the tide on deforestation. And it's really just a matter of pulling them all together in particular places. And frankly speaking, for those of us in rich countries to do our part in terms of signaling to the market that we don't want to buy products that come from recently deforested land and that we do want to provide the finance that we are certainly in a position to provide incentives to those political leaders in the forest-rich jurisdictions so that they have both an economically viable proposition as well as a politically viable proposition to their constituencies that protecting the forest is going to be good for their long-term well-being.
You know, earlier in the environmental movement, there used to be forest campaigners, and then there were climate campaigners. And now it seems both have discovered they can't live without each other. Do you think there's still more bonds and connections to be made between what you could call two camps?
Absolutely. And frankly, that's one of the reasons I'm here in San Francisco this week. You may have seen a blog I wrote earlier this year comparing the forest contribution to solving the problem of global climate change to Cinderella, in the sense that we are the stepsister that often gets left home at, you know, attending the hearth rather than being invited to the ball. There was some estimates published earlier this year showing that even though the land sector more generally, with the preponderance being from forests, can contribute around 30% of the climate mitigation actions that are needed before 2030 in order to meet the Paris Agreement targets, the sector gets less than 3% of the finance and an even lower percent of media attention and political attention. So we feel kind of neglected, you know, and that we need to up our visibility in the climate space. And so the slogan for the land sector challenge here in San Francisco at the Global Climate Action Summit is 30 by 30 for this, you know, 30% of mitigation actions by 2030. And we've got a long way to go to sort of claim our fair share of attention and finance to contribute what we can contribute. And I think it's also it's a balance issue in the sense for many developing countries, the largest single contribution they can make to solving the problem of global climate change is through land sector investments. And so we really need to increase the profile of those so that, you know, everybody has a part to play.
And I get people who warn about greenhouse gases from thawing permafrost, which is just beginning in a way, or Arctic methane, which is a big threat but hasn't fully developed. Meanwhile, I think we're seeing a very big, massive release of carbon from disappearing forests, and that doesn't get the emphasis that it should.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and it's that's not all. There's new science that's been coming out just over the last few years that suggests that the impact of tropical deforestation on global warming is not just through the pathway of carbon fluxes. You know, it's not just that tropical forests store so much carbon or that deforestation releases so much CO2 into the atmosphere, but that because of their role in evapotranspiration in terms of, you know, cycling water in and out of the atmosphere and across continents, and these biogenic, you know, volatile organic compounds that forests release that, you know, have play a role in seeding clouds, and the role of forests in providing a surface roughness on the Earth's surface that affects wind patterns. For all of those reasons, forests actually play a role. They're actually part of the climate system. They're not just contributing to it, you know, in the way that, you know, a tailpipe might spew emissions into the atmosphere. And so when you add up all those additional effects, that's like a multiplier effect. And so the impact of deforestation on climate change may even be more than we have realized up to now. And so, you know, when you mention issues like, you know, the thawing permafrost and methane being released into the atmosphere, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do about that other than slowing down global warming overall. And the most effective, you know, cheapest, readily available technology for doing that is keeping the forest that we already have standing as part of the critical, vital infrastructure of that global climate system. And so it should be a much higher priority on everyone's radar screen than it currently is. And I have to say, I sort of lose patience sometimes when I read articles in the newspaper about, you know, the high-tech carbon capture and storage, you know, technologies that billions of dollars are being invested in to come up with, you know, an engineered way of taking carbon out of the atmosphere. And it's like, we already have that technology. It's called tropical forests, and we're systematically destroying it on a daily basis. So we really need to shift our focus and really preserve that natural technology that we already have for stabilizing the climate before rushing off to these other more speculative, expensive options.
Well, you know, even myself, I try and keep track of these issues, but I was wondering, well, which is winning the race of deforestation, logging or wildfires? And it turns out that it's a third larger factor. It's what you talked about, the production of commodities. Soy, beef, and palm oil are the bad boys of wrecking forests. Could you take a little time to educate us about that?
I'd say that, you know, we have our mental models that you know, don't get updated as quickly as the world changes. And so I think you're not alone in, maybe thinking that, oh, it's, you know, logging is the main cause. And sure, logging continues to be a cause, you know, in many places. And as I say, it's often, you know, it is what makes forests more vulnerable to wildfires, for example. So these variables are not mutually independent. Another outdated view that a lot of people have is that, oh, yes, forests are being replaced by agriculture, but it's all these smallholders small farmers who are chipping away at the forest edge. And yes, that is true in some places, and indeed in sub-Saharan Africa, most of the tree cover loss is due to small-scale agriculture, you know, in the forest. But by far the largest driver in Latin America and in Southeast Asia are these large commercial scale, hundreds of thousands of hectare size plantations for palm oil or large soy farms or large cattle pastures. And these, you know, we are complicit in this because we in the industrialized countries are markets for these products as well as everyone else. And so these are global commodity markets, and we have a infographic in our book showing big arrows, you know, going from one continent to another that show the embodied carbon emissions, for example, embodied in the beef that's exported from Brazil to the European Union. And the data that we included in our book was from 2009, and already those arrows were pretty thick. And since then, you know, they've gotten quite a bit larger. So that's why the campaigners have more recently turned their attention to these commodity supply chains, companies that participate in them, ranging all the way from the consumer-facing manufacturers and retailers, and then going all the way back to the, you know, through the traders to the ultimate producers, to say, look, we need to agree on rules of the game that we need to focus on intensifying production on land that, you know, has already been cleared, or expansion only into lands that are not valuable for carbon storage or for biodiversity conservation, or are, you know, already encumbered by rights of indigenous peoples or some other reason that they're off limits. And that is a process that really just started within the last 5 years. So it's early days in figuring out how to do it. And when this conversation started, most companies had no idea where their palm oil came from, right? It's, by definition, a commodity is something that's sort of an interchangeable good, and you just buy it where you can get it, and it's all the same. And so now a lot of these companies are struggling with the very difficult challenge of tracing their supply chains to figure out, okay, well, where does that palm oil come from? And then figuring out ways to discriminate between palm oil that comes from a plantation that's been opened inside of a national park versus the palm oil that's come from an area that has been certified. And it's complex stuff, and we have a small army of people working on it and a number of progressive companies trying to do the right thing, some other companies that have said they want to do the right thing but don't seem to be doing very much, and some other companies who haven't even said they're going to try to do the right thing and are continuing to deforest in some of the most precious tropical forests on the planet. So it's a big challenge, but we've made a lot of progress just in the last 5 years in understanding the nature of the problem and trying to identify solutions. And I'd say it's one of the most exciting spaces right now in this whole field, precisely because everybody understands the urgency of getting on top of it, and nobody has a silver bullet answer, but we have lots of pieces of the answer, and we're just in the process of bringing them all together.
And you wrote an interesting blog about that, about using, about mining global financial data to increase transparency. And I know, too, that the Rainforest Action Network, they have a subgroup that is doing audits to try and find where the wood is coming from for melting wood down to make rayon in the fashion industry. So there are a lot of groups working on trying to help companies figure out where the wood should be coming from so that we don't have to cut the world down.
That's exactly right. And actually, there's the blog that you mentioned about sort of trying to mine some of this data on corporations has exposed a lot of illegality where corporations sort of mask their relationships to other corporations so that they can sort of publicly claim to have a clean supply chain without, you know, revealing that actually this company to which they have a sister relationship is actively deforesting somewhere else. So it's becoming increasingly difficult for companies to hide behind those kinds of mask relationships. But also this new technology that I mentioned for monitoring tree cover loss is allowing the linkage. When you combine that data with trade data, you can actually start exposing the origin of particular shipments of, say, soybeans and follow them through different companies and trip ports and traders all the way to their ultimate destination. There's a new platform called Traze, T-R-A-S-E, that has developed a platform where you can sort of click on a particular producing jurisdiction and follow that supply chain all the way to the ultimate destination of where the soybeans produced in particular municipality of Brazil, you know, end up, you know, in what country in Europe. And I think that is helping companies understand that even if their narrow supply chain may be clean, if they're linked to sourcing from an area where there's active deforestation taking place, that's both a material and a reputational risk for them, and they need to be part of the solution in addressing deforestation in that sourcing jurisdiction. And that means reaching out to other stakeholders locally, including local government, the farming communities, indigenous communities, other NGOs, civil society actors in that area, to sort of work together to solve the problem. So there are a lot of initiative. It goes under the banner of the so-called jurisdictional approach to addressing commodity-driven deforestation. And there are a lot of conversations going on about that right now and a number of initiatives in a few particular places where a progressive governor, for example, has said, look, we want to shift towards more sustainable land uses. And the international community is trying to mobilize to be helpful and support that domestic initiative.
How can the average person tune in to what is happening? Do you have websites or Twitter feeds to recommend?
Well, I certainly have to start with my colleagues at Global Forest Watch at World Resources Institute. The Global Forest Watch platform is just an amazing interface that allows you to select what particular geography you're interested in. So you could zoom in on Indonesia and see a chart of what has been the tree cover loss in Indonesia over the last years. You can click on an area of interest like wildfires, if that's what you're interested in, and see the alerts on wildfire, incidents in different places, and allows you to do your own analysis. And so it's probably that would be my go-to place to start for an understanding of what's going on in the global deforestation picture.
And as we wrap up here, Frances, is there anything else that you'd like to talk to our listeners about?
I would just say that often the deforestation problem is characterized as an environmental problem, and it's only about global climate change or global biodiversity loss. But as I mentioned at the start of this program, in the case of wildfires, for example, the biggest immediate cost is to public health. And so there is a lot of respiratory disease, premature deaths that are attributed to the decline in air quality based on as a result of wildfires. And I think you probably have seen that where you live in British Columbia or other places that have experienced fires in temperate areas recently as well. In the tropics, the loss of forests is even more important for human well-being in that there are still hundreds of millions of people who depend for important parts of their daily livelihoods for wild products derived from the forest. They get their proteins from hunting bushmeat. They may have important parts of their diet that come from gathering, various food products, natural food products from the forest. Or they may depend on small-scale timber activities or charcoal to earn cash income. And so when a forest is lost or, converted to a palm oil plantation, all those sources of income go away, and so some of the poorest people in the world can be made worse off. And in addition, some of the unpriced ecosystem services that are delivered locally, whether it's, clean water for drinking and sanitation or pollination services for, crops along the forest edge, are also lost. So there's a very important social justice dimension to forest loss where the communities that live in and around forests and often indigenous communities who are already among the poorest and most vulnerable people on our planet are made worse off. So from both an environmental perspective as well as from a concern about human well-being and social justice, deforestation is a big issue.
We have been speaking with the well-known force for the forests, Frances Seymour from the World Resources Institute. You can find links to Frances, her blog, Global Forest Watch, which I also use, and much more in my show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much, Frances, for your work for the forests and for joining us today.
Thank you, Alex.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Now that's a loaded hour. Good for you for going all the way. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening, and please join me again next week for Radio EcoShock.